there'll be no one who will have the same broad portfolio that Craig did.
Alaska Attorney General Craig Richards resigns. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, June 23rd. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the USDA announces $16 million in energy cost mitigation grants for Alaska.
It's involvement of the community building the project, maintaining the project, getting to a point where maybe Alaska exports its talent in microgrids instead of just oil.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration set standards for the operation of aircraft and airports and provide services to the flying public. Passengers are influential in making flying safer in Alaska. When passengers know their rights and responsibilities, aviation is safer for everyone. Safety information online at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
Alaska Attorney General Craig Richards resigned today. He says he's stepping down to focus on his family. Richards is one of Governor Bill Walker's closest advisors. His responsibilities extended well beyond legal issues, including playing a lead role in shaping Walker's plan to restructure permanent fund earnings. Former Attorney General Bruce Botello worked with Richards as part of Walker's transition team. He notes Richards has longtime ties with Walker, beginning with spending 10 years as his law partner.
The governor viewed Craig as a key component to the partnership. Then, in the course of the campaign, Craig, aside from the governor's wife, Donna, was his closest advisor.
Richards' resignation came suddenly. Today is his last day. Botello says Richards will be difficult to replace.
I think it's fair to say that there will be no one who will have the same broad portfolio that Craig did.
Richards frequently served as the administration's face during committee hearings and in private meetings with lawmakers. Walker noted in announcing the resignation that Richards' work pulled him away from his three-year-old son. According to state records, Richards and his wife filed for divorce in late May. Walker says he's grateful for the sacrifices Richards and his family made. Walker expressed confidence that the state will continue to benefit from Richards' knowledge. Jim Cantor, currently the state's deputy attorney general, will step in to lead the Department of Law until Governor Walker appoints a new attorney general. In the second shakeup to his cabinet today, Governor Walker announced a new DNR commissioner. Andy Mack, an Arctic policy and development advisor and manager of Point Capital, a private equity fund based in Alaska, will take over the agency. Former Commissioner Mark Myers retired in February. Reached by phone early in the day, Mack said he didn't want to discuss the new position without a confirmation from the governor's office. Mack did not return phone calls as of press time. Walker's announcement came after acting DNR Commissioner Marty Rutherford told Walker she plans to retire in June, according to a media release. She won't be leaving the public eye, however, as Walker announced he's appointing her to the board of the Permanent Fund Corporation as of July. Rutherford did not immediately return a phone call seeking comment. Anchorage Democratic Senator Bill Wilikowski says Rutherford's exit will be a blow to the department's institutional knowledge.
It's a loss for the state. You know, she's someone who's been through a number of different iterations on gasoline policy and on oil tax issues. And so, yeah, I hate to see her go.
The DNR commissioner is heavily involved in the state's effort to build a massive natural gas pipeline to bring gas down from the North Slope. A Walker spokesperson says he is traveling today and not available to talk about the cabinet shakeup and his new appointments. In this strange election year, Republican members of Congress are still lukewarm about their party's presumptive nominee for president, Donald Trump. APRN's Liz Ruskin spoke to Alaska's congressional delegation and found their support for Trump these days is hovering between tepid and chilly.
Alaska's sole House member, Don Young, says he might choose himself for president as a write-in. He could be joking about that, but Young sounds sincere when he says he's not sure he can manage to vote for Trump.
I don't know. It depends what he does to the end of the election. If he does the correct things, and I expect it, a lot of it be, he'll announce, I'm confident, who will be the cabinet members, which mean a lot. If he appoints people that I think can do the job, there'd be a strong possibility I might vote for him.
Young says that possibility diminishes if Trump, in his view, continues to speak without thinking. Senator Dan Sullivan is less direct when asked how he feels about Trump. Sullivan says his attention has been on keeping the Senate in Republican hands. Also, Sullivan says the question should be how he feels about Democrat Hillary Clinton.
So my focus has been on the Senate and making sure she doesn't win the White House.
So you're carefully not saying how you feel about Mr. Trump these days?
What I've said is when on issues where I disagree with Mr. Trump, whether it's policy or, you know, statements that I think are appropriate, I will be forthright when asked.
Senator Lisa Murkowski, on the train that runs under the Capitol complex, said she did not like Trump's statements after the mass shooting in Orlando.
To kind of come back and say that we should ban Muslims is not, in my view, the response to a horrible, horrible tragedy.
Asked if she still supported Trump, Murkowski sounded less than sure.
When it comes to the presidential elections, I've always been able to support the Republican nominee. And, you know, the good news is that we've got a lot of time before, maybe that's not good news, but we do have a lot of time before this election and before the time we have to vote.
All three Alaska lawmakers say they like Trump's energy policy, as he announced it in a recent speech in North Dakota, and all three said Trump would be better for Alaska than Clinton would be. As Congressman Young put it, he'll vote for anybody but Hillary. Reporting from the U.S. Capitol, I'm Liz Ruskin.
The U.S. Department of Agriculture's Rural Development Agency today announced more than $16 million in federal grants for energy projects in communities across Alaska. The high energy cost grants fund projects in areas where households are paying nearly triple the national average for their energy. 9 of this year's federal grants went to towns, tribal organizations, and utilities in rural Alaska. The projects range from $500,000 for the city of Grayling to build a system that will capture and convert heat from its diesel plant, to $3 million for Alaska Village Electric Co-op, or AVEC, to develop a grid that will connect towns to a planned wind farm in the Yukon Delta. All the projects focus on the use of alternative energy sources or increasing efficiency, an effort to reduce dependence on diesel. At a press conference at the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium in Anchorage today, AVEC President Mira Kohler says the federal dollars make the difference in a state where the economies of scale for utility projects are so small.
It's not as if it's a gimme or a handout. It really is critical to make these projects actually viable.
Patrick Boonstra works for Intelligent Energy Systems, which is working with the city of Pilot Point on the Alaska Peninsula to install a wind turbine and electric stoves, thanks to a grant. He says funding these renewable projects in rural areas is about more than just making energy cheaper.
It's not just the new technology that's very exciting. It's involvement of the community, building the project, maintaining the project, and all the training that goes into the people development and getting to a point where maybe Alaska exports its talent in microgrids instead of just oil.
Grant recipients still have work to do in order to get their funding. Applicants will need to complete environmental reviews for their projects. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the competitive spirit of the Anchorage woman who won a 4,200-mile bike race.
All of a sudden, I was like, oh my gosh, this is the guy I've been chasing. So I just took off. I started just sprinting away.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Boating accidents happen even to experienced boaters and even on calm, sunny days. This boating season, make your friends and loved ones promise to always wear a life jacket and carry emergency communication and distress signaling devices. Visit pledgetolive.org where you can file a float plan, get marine weather forecasts, and download a pre-departure checklist. This message sponsored by the Alaska Office of Boating Safety.
Lael Wilcox is a woman of many firsts. The 29-year-old Anchorage resident and world bicycle traveler just won the 4,200-mile Trans-Am bike race. She was the first woman and the first American to win the grueling race. Wilcox started the race on June 4th in Astoria, Oregon, and won yesterday in Virginia. The Trans-Am race is self-supported. Wilcox says you have to carry what you need or buy it along the way.
So people just do whatever they can to get to the other side of the country. And the first person across wins. So you decide when you sleep, when you eat, just kind of how you're going to manage your days to make the greatest distance.
You're really kind of a relatively new racer in these ultra long distance races. Tell us how you got started.
I started, I just started commuting on the bike about 10 years ago. To get to and from work. I've never owned or driven a car. And then after commuting, I started traveling on the bike with my boyfriend, Nick. And we've been traveling all over the world for the past 8 years. Usually we travel for about 6 months and then work for the other six. So I've got a lot of experience just being on the bike. And then I transitioned that into ultra endurance racing.
And when was your first long distance race? That was in Israel, is that correct?
Right. Well, so the summer before that, I did ride the Fireweed 400. So it's a 400-mile road race from Sheep Mountain Lodge to Valdez and back. And that's supported. So I had a friend following me in her Jeep. And that was the first time I really did anything long. And then the following spring, I did the race in Israel, which was 850-mile mountain bike race. And this time, self-supported. And I just had a great time, and after that I decided I would continue and kind of go for the even longer distances.
Have you sort of surprised yourself at your ability? I mean, you're a woman of many firsts, and you're quite young. How does this feel to, just in the last few years, discover this tremendous ability that you have?
It is really surprising. It's just not something you really could know you can do until you try. I had no idea. You know, it's like I started to realize, wow, I recover a lot faster than other people and I'm able to ride more. And my body doesn't really wear out. Mentally, I stay focused and I stick with it.
During the race that you just completed, Stefan Struck was in front. You rode hard to catch him and had an interesting exchange on the race route when you met up with him. Tell us about that.
I had been, you know, chasing this guy for 2 weeks, basically. I'd never seen him, never met him, didn't know what he looked like, but everyone is telling me, oh, Stefan is about 50 miles in front of you. I can watch how we're doing. We have no idea how the other person's doing. You're just kind of out there by yourself. And then in the middle of the night, the day of the end of the race, I took a cat nap for about half an hour, and then I got up to ride. I saw a light coming towards me, and it was all dark otherwise. We're in really rural Virginia. And I thought, who is that? You know, somebody on a bike with a really bright light. When I caught up to him, we crossed paths, and then he turned around and started riding the same direction as me. And I looked over at him, and he's, you know, he looks like a racer. And I asked, what's your name? And he said, Stefan. And all of a sudden, I was like, oh, my gosh, this is the guy I've been chasing. So I just took off. I started just sprinting away. And he was, of course, holding on. We're both sprinting side by side through basically farmlands in Virginia in the middle of the night. And we're making turns, there's stop signs. I was riding really aggressively just because I was giving it my all. But at the same time, we're 130 miles from the finish. So it's like I knew that I wasn't going to be able to sprint for 130 miles. I took a wrong turn on the track. I wasn't focused enough on the map, and I turned to the left, and he said, it's to the right, and he kind of slowed down for me to catch up, and he said, I want to talk to you for a minute, and he said, we've been battling for 2 weeks. Why don't we just finish this together? And I said, no way. This is a race. I'm going to finish it. So I just kept riding hard. We rode together for a couple more minutes, and then he dropped off, and I never saw him again.
Anchorage resident Lael Wilcox is the first woman and first American to win the Trans Am bike race. Photos of her race are at our website, alaskapublic.org. You could call them extreme athletes, determined paddlers and sailors, or maybe just crazy. But around 60 teams are trying to make it from Washington State to Ketchikan on boats without motors. Northwest News Network correspondent Tom Bonsi reports from Port Townsend, Washington, where the race to Alaska's qualifying round began this morning.
Any size crew, any size boat can compete as long as it has no motor and can get to Ketchikan without support. Entries range from racing catamarans and comfortable trimarans to sloops, veritable dinghies, several kayaks, and one stand-up paddleboard. Then there's the 26-foot open long dory. Jill Russell will help row to Alaska.
I'm the captain of Team Kraken Up, and that's K-R-A-K-E-N.
Russell says the 8-member, all-female crew is prepared for hardship.
For us, it was more about pushing ourselves outside of our comfort zone and really embracing the adventure. And so we thought, what is the most ridiculous hard way we could do this race? And so we found the boat that matched kind of our paradigm.
Last year's winner reached the finish line in 5 days. Jill Russell hopes to row there in around 2 weeks. I'm Tom Bonsi in Port Townsend, Washington.
A national environmental group is challenging Blue Crest Energy's plans to conduct hydraulic fracturing in Cook Inlet, citing concerns for endangered beluga whales. The Center for Biological Diversity sent a letter to the National Marine Fisheries Service asking it to take a closer look at the potential harms of fracking in the inlet. Blue Crest is targeting oil wells in the Cosmopolitan Unit, about 3.5 miles offshore and 7,000 feet below the surface of Cook Inlet. The company plans to drill from its pad onshore, about 7 miles north of Anchor Point. Kristen Monsell, staff attorney for the center, says fracking could cause oil spills, toxic chemical leaks, earthquakes, and noise pollution. Blue Crest has said that its drilling and fracking plans pose virtually no risk of water contamination or earthquakes. A spokesperson for the Fisheries Service says the letter has not yet been reviewed. Alaska road crews have dislodged a massive boulder that was poised to come crashing down on a highway busy with summer travelers. This morning's work followed a rock slide that pushed a van-sized rock to a precipice over the Seward Highway near Potter Marsh, south of Anchorage. The Seward Highway is the only road leading south out of the city. State Department of Transportation spokeswoman Jill Reese says crews dislodged the rock with a high-pressure water hose. She says the boulder came to rest on the cliffside lane, but it was too large to move, even for two front loaders. Reese says crews are breaking up the rock and hoping to have it removed later today. Subsistence fishermen on the Yukon are getting some rare gill net openings during the middle of the summer season and will be allowed to keep any king salmon they catch. Targeted openings for Yukon king salmon have not occurred in more than 5 years, though occasionally subsistence users are allowed to keep kings taken as bycatch in the summer chum fishery. Fish and Game Yukon River summer season manager Holly Carroll says the idea of allowing gill nets during the heart of the summer run has been developing since the end of the 2015 fishing season, when subsistence users up and down the Yukon repeatedly criticized managers for not enabling people to meet their subsistence needs. When it came time to discuss the 2016 management plans last winter, Carroll says subsistence users and fishery managers came to a consensus.
We kind of told them that we'd rather, if the run looks strong enough, to provide a little bit more subsistence harvest than last year. And most people gave us a lot of feedback on how they would want that they want it soon enough to be able to dry their fish. They want it, you know, before all the kings are old or unusable upriver. They also wanted chums when they were fresher for the people that harvest chums. And so We basically, at those meetings, we present our management strategy, and then we take all the feedback that we're given, and we try to incorporate what people say they actually want.
The openings are being timed to fall after a large second pulse of Kings moves upriver in order to minimize the impact that the more efficient gillnet gear could have on the struggling King salmon stock. The 2016 King run appears to be similar in size to last year's run, when more than 85,000 Kings crossed into Canada, almost twice as much as required by a treaty between the U.S. and Canada. Fish and Wildlife Service Yukon River in-season manager Fred Bew acknowledges that managers achieve that high level of escapement in part by virtually eliminating subsistence fishing time. But this year, Bew says, managers want to provide better subsistence opportunities on the river.
There's no way we're going to meet people's needs, but we do hope to get a little bit of fish for people to use. And we hope to have it not right on the back end of the run when the quality of fish kind of deteriorates. It's not nearly as good as those very first fresh fish. If they're going to harvest a fish, we would like to get the maximum benefit out of it.
A series of 18-hour openings utilizing gill nets with a maximum mesh size of 6 inches have occurred in lower river districts 1 and 2, and similar opportunities will be afforded to middle and upper river districts over the next few weeks. A 6-inch mesh restriction for gill nets is intended to select the smaller males while allowing spawning females to escape. Middle and upper river fishermen are more likely to harvest kings as the runs separate and chums turn off into tributaries to spawn. The pilot station sonar estimate for Kings on Tuesday was just over 91,000 fish, about 18,000 above the 10-year average for that date. Managers attribute some of that high number to the early run timing this year.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by BP Alaska. As part of their commitment to Alaska, BP and their employees are investing in over 400 education and service organizations in communities across the state. More at alaska.bp.com.
The Business Administration program at Alaska Pacific University delivers a distinctive education grounded in real-world experience with life-friendly schedules designed to support your personal and professional goals. Move forward with APU and apply today at alaskapacific.edu. This message sponsored by APU. Support for Alaska Public Media's Energy News Desk comes from Bettesworth North, Architects and Planners, and the Atwood Foundation.
United States Supreme Court Justice Sonia Sotomayor is scheduled to speak at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. UAF Summer Sessions will host Sotomayor at the Davis Concert Hall on August 14th. A release announcing her visit says details are still being worked out, but that the public will be able to submit questions for Sotomayor. Sotomayor became the first Hispanic member of the Supreme Court when appointed to the panel by President Obama in 2009. A long-studied and viewed Denali National Park wolf pack is on the verge of disappearing. The East Fork Pack ranges near the park entrance, including on state land wolf advocates wanted closed to harvest. As KUAC's Dan Bross reports, the fate of the East Fork Pack has also inspired a call for closer pack monitoring and rescue of any orphan pups.
The last known adult male of the East Fork Wolf Pack was observed from the air to be dead at a hunting camp on state land outside the park's northeast boundary in early May. Park Natural Resources team leader Dave Schurekauer says the pack's other known remaining member, a pregnant female, denned nearby.
We know that she has at least two pups in that den. They were observed during one of our wildlife tracking flights. So we did set eyes on two pups in that den. We did not see the mom at that time. We assumed she was out hunting.
Schurekauer says the wolf den will continue to be monitored for activity from the air, but the chances of a mother and pup surviving alone are slim. The East Fork Pack has been studied for decades and used to be popularly viewed by park visitors.
These Denali wolves are million-dollar rock stars.
Denali wolf advocate Rick Steiner says the current situation follows the loss of an East Fork Pack breeding pair to harvest in the same area last year. The pack's decline is part of a more general dip in Denali's wolf population that's inspired unsuccessful efforts by Steiner and environmental groups to get the state to close the land east of the park along the Stampede Road to wolf killing.
They could have closed it. They should have closed it and protected this group. They didn't. And now the group is essentially gone.
Aside from the broader debate about whether or not to protect Denali wolves on state land, Steiner is pushing for on-the-ground monitoring of the East Fork pack and taking any orphan pups into captivity. The Park Service's Schierkauer says the agency favors letting nature take its course, noting even if it wanted to act, it doesn't have jurisdiction.
Given that the den is on state land, it's really up to the state if there's any sort of human intervention.
We have no information at this time that suggests there is a need to take action regarding this wolf den.
Alaska Department of Fish and Game Regional Wildlife Supervisor Darren Bruning does not rule out the possibility of taking orphaned wolf pups into captivity, but says it needs to be clear the pups are alone.
The sighting of pups, but no adults, would not necessarily be a true indicator of the situation. There very well could be adult animals that were not seen.
Bruning notes two situations in recent years in which clearly orphaned wolf pups were removed from the wild by the state and given to care facilities or zoos. He says the state is not actively monitoring the Denali East Fork Pack Den, but is getting regular updates from the National Park Service. The park Schierkauer says a single pup was observed during a June 17th overflight of the den area. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
The Tetlin River fire south of Tok is estimated now at just under 820 acres. That's nearly 200 acres smaller than previously thought. Officials from the Alaska Division of Forestry say the adjustment is due to improved mapping of the fire's perimeter. Crews yesterday continued mop-up operations on the blaze, focusing on hot spots and putting in containment lines. Nearly 300 personnel are still working the fire. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org, and you can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Rasha McChesney and Andrew Kitchenman in Juneau, Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Graylin Brashear and Josh Edge in Anchorage, Tom Bonsi in Port Washington, Jenny Nyman in Kenai, Tim Bodoni in Galena, and Dan Bross in Fairbanks. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Wesley Early is our web editor. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
BP Alaska. As part of their commitment to Alaska, BP and their employees are investing in over 400 education and service organizations in communities across the state. More at alaska.bp.com.
And by
GCI, serving more than 100 Alaska communities. GCI's Alaska Born and Raised campaign celebrates the people who call Alaska home. GCI.com/share your story. The University of Alaska Southeast specializes in you. UAS is a learning community where your professors or mentors and friends on campus and online. UAS.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Southeast. The Resource Basket is a training and technical assistance center helping rural communities support healthy, resilient, and culturally connected youth. Tribes and youth-serving organizations can request support, explore resources, and find opportunities at resourcebasket.org or call the team directly at 1-800-478-7227, extension 7396. This message sponsored by the Rural Alaska Community Action Program.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.